Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Tzarich Ched Amud Bet. The Mishnah says, Eshuelet a para. Person who borrows a para, we actually saw this quoted in the Gemara in Baba Kama, because there we saw Machloket with regards to Shlichut, which we'll note here again, which is someone who is borrowing a para, Vishalchalo biyad bino, biyad abdo, biyad shlucho, and the mashil, the lender, sends it to the borrower in the hands of his child, his servant, or his proxy, his messenger. Oh, or the other alternative is biyad bino, biyad avdo, biyad shlucho shel shoel. He sends it in the hands of the child, the eved, the servant, and the messenger of the shoel, the borrower, umeta, and it dies on its way to the shoel, patur. He does not have liability for that. He does not become liable for it until it reaches him. And the reason is, according to a machloket Rabban Rav Chista that we saw in the Gemara in Bava Kama, over here, why is it that he is not responsible for it when his shliach, when his proxies, whether it's his child, his eved, or his shliach, picks up the item from the individual? Rav Chista says that the shlucho over here is b'schiro l'kito, shedar b'beito. It's talking about someone who is close to him, someone who works by him, but not appointed officially as a shliach. So when we say shlucho, it's not literally his shliach, his messenger that is going to pick it up, but rather it is a shliach that is acting on behalf of the shoel, but it's not official in any way because there are no edim. There's no witnesses to the fact that he appointed him as a shliach. It's just assumed that this individual who works with the shoel will take it on behalf of the shoel. And that's why the shoel was not chayav inon sin over here. Whereas, if he actually sent a proxy, literally sent the shliach to pick it up, then the shoel would be chayav inon sin, because that would be his proxy picking up on his behalf. On the other hand, Rabba says that shlucho in our Mishnah means literally a shliach, a proxy that was sent, ayidei edim, he appointed him as a shliach. But he does not make him a shliach to receive the item, or to begin the she'ilah, but rather simply to be a shaliach, and rather to tell the mashiach, if you want to send it with someone, this guy is Naaman. This guy is reliable. This is a guy that I trust. But he does not accept any responsibility with that. So obviously the machlok between Rav Chista and Rabbo is as to whether when you send a shliach, an official shliach, does that change the dynamic here? According to Rav Chista, it does. And the shoel would be responsible once he gets it. On the other hand, Rabbo believes that even the sending of a shliach is not enough, because there he's just saying that I believe this guy, or this guy's a quality individual. He's not saying that I'm taking responsibility. And so the shoel is not responsible until it reaches his possession. On the other hand, Amar lo ha-shoel shalchali biyad bini, biyad avdi, biyad shluchi. If the shoel initiates and says, send it to me with my son, with my eved, or with my proxy, oh, or he says, send it biyad bincha, biyad avdcha, biyad shluchecha, or he says, send it with your son, your eved, or your shaliach, o she'amar lo ha-mashil. Or the other possibility is that the lender says to him, hareini mishalcha lecha biyad bini, biyad avdi, biyad shluchi. I am going to send it to you with my son, my eved, or my shliach. Or I'm going to send it to you, biyad bincha, biyad avdcha, biyad shluchecha. You're going to send it through your son, your eved, or your shliach. V'amar lei ha-shoel. And the shoel responds and says, shalach, send it. Then, vishalcha, once he does send it, umeita, and it dies, chayav. In that instance, the shoel is chayav. So here, the shoel becomes chayav for one of two reasons. Either he's the initiator in sending to send it with whomever, whether it's his child, eved, or shliach, or whether it's the child, eved, or shliach of the mishaleach, or the mishaleach is the initiator, but he is inquiring as to whether the shoel wants this done, and the shoel approves and says, yes, send it with them. So then he's in essence acquiescing to them being his shaliach or his proxies. And therefore, if anything happens on the way, he is responsible. He is chayav for the animal. V'chein b'shat shemachzira. And the same is true, but just in the reverse, when he's returning the item, as to whose responsibility it's going to be. If it's the shoel initiating, then in that case, the shoel will be chayav until it reaches the point of the mashil. If it's the mashil initiating, or the shoel asks the mashil and the mashil agrees, then it will be the mashil's problem if it dies on the way back. The Rishonim over here ask, and even into the Gemara, about where is the initiation of the obligation over here. Meaning that how does the person become chayav if there is no kinyan mishicha that exists over here? How is it that he's responsible for the animal, especially if the mashil sends it with his own eved, his own son? Why is it that this individual is chayav? Where did the chit chayvut start? So the Ran, based on that, suggests over here that the nature of the responsibility is not because you've made a kinyan and you are a shoel, but because of arevut. Because you basically become a guarantor to the item. And that through your becoming an arev, you are responsible for the item as a guarantor of the health or the well-being of the item that is being sent. And so there isn't a kinyan mishicha that is absent, and that'll be apparent in the Gemara as well. That sometimes we see that there is no kinyan mishicha, and despite that fact, we're saying that the shoel is chayav, which means that there must be some other vehicle for making him chayav, and the Ran claims that that's arevut. Otherwise, you have to say that he's doing it through shlichut. His acceptance of these individuals to carry the item to him becomes shlichim, and therefore his receipt of the item happens immediately upon the shlichim acting on his behalf to bring the item, whether it's his own people or whether it's the people of the mashil. And the different reasons why we'll have a nafkamina as to why this is not considered to be sheila bibalim. And number two is, when does the actual transaction get locked in? Is it at the time that it's given to the shliach, or only at the point in time when it reaches the shoel? So now the Gemara says, b'yadav do chayav? How could it be that if it comes in the hand of his slave, that he is chayav? The slave is the slave of the mashil, and the mashil is sending it with his slave, and yet we're saying the shoel is responsible for it. Well, then how does that work? Yad eved ki yad rabo. Don't we have a general principle that the eved is an extension of his master? He is the property of his master, an extension of his master. If that's the case, then when the mashil sends it with his own eved, it's still in the possession of the mashil. And so how could you argue that the shoel should be responsible in this instance, because it never left the possession of the mashil? So now we have two answers to that question. Rav and Shmuel. Amar Shmuel be'eved ivri, delo kani le gufei. Shmuel says we're referencing to an eved ivri, where there's a difference between an eved ivri and an eved kanani. Eved kanani is the property of its owner, and therefore it's yad eved ki yad rabo. The eved is simply an extension of his master. If that's the case, then it's clear that the mashil would be responsible if it went with his eved. But since it was an eved ivri, where he does not have ownership over the eved himself, simply he has rights to his output, even though in the Gemara and Kiddushin there is an opinion there of Rava that an eved ivri is nikne the gufo, it's also their kinyan a guf. Nevertheless, that is not a full-fledged ownership, as Tosafot points out over here, but rather an ownership for certain aspects, but not ownership in the sense that he becomes a extension of his master. And so therefore over here he used an eved ivri. An eved ivri is no different than his son, or no different than any other shaliach that would be used. And so therefore it has left the possession, in a sense, of the mashil. Rav amar, afilu tema be'eved knani, even if you want to suggest the Mishnah is an eved knani, nase ke omer. To the mashil, ekisha be'makel v'hi tavo. Give it a little kick, hit it with the stick, and it will go. So the individual is not saying that he wants someone to accompany it necessarily, but rather when he says, go ahead and send it, he's like, give it a little push, it'll go. And if you want to, you can send your eved along with it in order to watch that it goes, but not that he's making the eved extension or a proxy over here, but simply that he will accompany the animal, but not that he is actually in possession of the animal at that time. Mar says, Meitavei, we have a braita that seems to undermine what Rav is saying. A shoel para, shalchalo biyad bino, biyad shlucho, chayav. A shoel, a borrower of a para, that was sent to him by his son or by his shaliach, chayav. Biyad abdo, but if it's sent with his eved, patur. Bishlam al Shmuel, for Shmuel I can understand the difference here. Matznitin be'eved ivri. Our Mishnah is talking about an eved ivri, and therefore in the Mishnah, you'd also be chayav, because the eved ivri is considered to be a separate entity from the master. And therefore where he sends it through these individuals and the Shoel acquiesces to that, then, of course, the Shoel will be Chayav. But in the case of our Braita, Be'evid Kanani, the Braita is talking about an Evid Kanani, and therefore he is Patur, the Shoel, because the Evid Kanani is still an extension of the Mashiel, and it's as if it never left the possession of the Mashiel. Elo Rav, Kasha, how's Rav going to reconcile between our Mishnah and the Braita, where our Mishnah says you are Chayav, and the Braita says you are Patur with regards to an Evid? For Rav, our Mishnah is even talking about an Eved Kanani. That's the case. How do you get a case where he is Patur? So Amar Lecha Rav, Lo Tema Nasek Amarle. Don't say like before where I said, it's if he said this. Ela Ema Ba'amarle, Kisha B'makel, V'hi Tavo. Let's say that he literally said that, and that is the way that the Mishnah works. The Mishnah works because he specifically stated that I want you to just give it a hit and have it come my way. And that's all that the Shoel asked for. It's not as if he asked for that. He did ask for that. And that makes him responsible as soon as the Mashiel gives it a little bump and it goes out of his property. He's going to be responsible for it. And as Rashi notes, just Bishum the Shalach Abdoima lo Miftar. Just because he sent his Eved to go along with it doesn't make the Shoel Patur, because the Shoel only asked for him to simply give it a little bump and hit it with the stick and have it come my way. Now, if it was the Shoel who was driving the animal, that would be a kinyan or a means of a kinyan. But here it's the Mashiel who is doing it, giving it a hit and sending it off to the Shoel. So this is where the Ran inquires as to where the kinyan is, because all he did was the Mashiel gave it a hit and it walks out. So why is the Shoel Chayav? So you have to say that he's Chayav Midin Arevut. And that's what I was noting in the Mishnah, that where there's a failure, a lack of kinyan, that would be made up by the fact that there is a revut or some sort of guarantee or guarantor here that makes him a chayav. De Itmar, so this is the position of Rav, because we have a memra. Hishilani paratcha, said, lend me your parav. Amalei biyad mi. Says to him, who should I send it with? Amalei kisha b'makel v'tavo. Says, give it a little hit and it'll come. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avua, Amar Rav. So this is Rav l'shitato. As soon as it leaves the possession of the Mashiel and dies, he will become a Chayav. So as long as it's in the property of the Mashiel, it's the Mashiel's issue. As soon as it exits the property of the Mashiel, it becomes the Shoel's issue. But you see here that there is a mechanism for transference of responsibility if he simply tells the Mashiel to give it a bump and have it come my way. Where it says, Nema Masayile. Let us say that this Braita is supportive of Rav's position. Hishilani paratcha, lend me your para, v'amarlei biadmi. And he says, who should I send it with? V'amarlei, hikisha b'makel, v'hitavo. Give it a little hit with the stick and it'll come my way. Kevin shiatzat mishut mashiel u'meita chayav. As soon as it leaves the possession of the mashiel and dies, the Shoel is responsible. Amar Ravashi, Ravashi says the Braita doesn't necessarily have to be a proof to Rav. The case there is a much narrower case. It's a case where the property of the Shoel was captive to the property of the Mashiel. That once he sends it, then for sure it will end up in the property of the Shoel, because there aren't too many other ways for it to go except to the property of the Shoel. Mar says, Ihochi, Maila Memra, that's the case. What's the Chiddush in the Braita at all? You have the Shoel's property that is captive. You have the Mashiel property around, and the Mashiel directed the animal towards the property of the Shoel. That's where he's going to go. There's nowhere else for it to go. It's going to end up in the property of the Shoel. Why do I need a Braita to tell me in that case that when it leaves the property of the Mashiel and goes into the property of the Shoel is Chayav? Tzricha de'ika gazaita, that there are these nooks and crannies. The Aruch translates it as that there are these windy paths, or the way Rashi is suggesting that there are nooks and crannies, there are hideouts that the animal can go into. Therefore, Maudutema lo samchadate. When he instructed the Mashiel to send it, he didn't really mean or rely on that, because he knows that the animal could get lost or hide out or not make it directly to his property. So Dilma Kaima Hotam, because maybe it'll remain in the property of the Mashiel, because of the fact that there are these alternatives for the animal to hide out or hang out in and not make it to the property of the Shoel. And it won't make it directly or openly to the property of the Shoel. Kamash Malon, the Braita tells us, the Samchadate, despite the possibilities of alternatives for the animal, despite the possibility that it might not get directly to the property of the Shoel, nevertheless, when the Shoel gives that instruction, we take it at face value and we assume that's really what he wants. And because that's what he wants, as soon as it leaves the property of the Mashiel and goes into the property of the Shoel, he will be responsible. So two things to note over here. One of which is you have a Braita that has the identical language to that of what Rav says. Gemara says, oh, let that Braita be supportive of Rav. Rav Ashi comes back and says, no, the Braita is not supportive of him because the Braita is a much narrower case. The truth is that you could say the same thing about Rav's position. We could say Rav's position is only in that narrow case as well. Why is the Gemara explaining the Braita and defining it, limiting it, qualifying it in this manner, but not the position of Rav? So what you have to explain is that there's a difference between a Tana and an Amora. A Tana writes b'lashon k'tzara. That is the nature of a Mishnah and a Braita, is that it was shorthand. That's why you need a Gemara to explain it or to explicate on it. An Amora, there is a demand on an Amora to make clear whatever his statement is. And so therefore, when Rav makes his statement, we take his statement at face value as applying to everything, unless he stated otherwise. In the Braita, where we have a shorthand form, if we can narrow the scope of the Braita, we will narrow the scope of the Braita or define it, because the Tana was writing in shorthand. And therefore, it leaves open the opportunity to redefine the Braita. So despite the fact that the Braita is identical in language to that of Rav, the Gemara is willing to, or Rav Ashi is willing to narrow the scope of the Braita so that it's not really a proof to Rav. From this, the Balei HaTosafot quote the Rabbeinu Hananel, which suggests that the Gemara believes that the Locha here is like Shmuel. So you have a Machloket Rav and Shmuel. By the time we figure out Rav's Shita, the truth is that Shmuel could subscribe to Rav's position. All Shmuel says is our Mishnah's Eved Ivri, that the Braita is an Eved Kanani. But the way that Rav describes it in the end, where he articulates specifically, that's the case in the Mishnah, that come hit it, and it'll come to me, who says that Shmuel would disagree in that case? Because that's a unique case of just hitting the animal and having it go. Maybe Shmuel would agree in that case that you'd be chayav, and he wouldn't need to make that distinction of Eved Knani and Eved Ivri, because of the nature of the articulation of this Shoel. So you could have argued that Shmuel agrees to Rav. But the Rabbeinu Hananel says, based on what the Gemara does here with the Braita, it's clear that number one, Rav and Shmuel are arguing, and Shmuel does not agree to this position of Rav. And number two is that the Gemara is favoring the position of Shmuel, because it takes an explicit Braita, which would have been supportive of Rav, and Bedochak squeezes it down into a qualified situation to say that it's not a proof for Rav. And from that, he concludes that the Halacha is like Shmuel, and that Shmuel and Rav are arguing, or that Shmuel does not agree to this position of Rav, even though it would be plausible or possible that he could agree to this position of Rav. That's number one. Number two is the situation or circumstances in a case where the property of the Shoel was captive to the property of the Mashiel. The truth is, you could have had the case be just the opposite, where the property of the Mashiel is on the inside, the property of the Shoel is on the outside. And then by definition, if the Mashiel hits the animal, it will exit to the property of the Shoel. And that actually might be even a simpler case, because that means in every direction that the animal leaves, it ends up going into the property of the Shoel. So why doesn't the Gemara explain it in that manner? Raivad answers, because in that case, if the property of the Mashiel is captive to that of the Shoel, the Mashiel has easement rights to cross the property of the Shoel. Because if he has a captive property, he needs to be able to exit. And that means that he has what's called driset regel, the right of passing through the property of the Shoel. And therefore, when he hits the animal and it goes out into the property of the Shoel, it's not clear that it's going into the possession of the Shoel. Because even the Mashiel has rights in the property of the Shoel. And that's why the Gemara didn't give the example in that manner. Now, we noted before that Rashi says over here that when he said the Eved along with the animal after hitting it, that doesn't make it that the Eved is responsible or remains in the possession of the owner. Tosafot goes one step further to explain that this is not considered to be She'ela Bebalim. Because we noted before in the Gemara, we had a question as to whether when an Eved stands in for his master, is that considered to be Sheila Bibalim? And that's what Tosfot says over here. Afal Pisha Avdo Molicha, even though his Eved is accompanying the animal, Lavi Sheila Bibalim. That's not considered to be Sheila Bibalim. Bad Amran Yad Eved Kiyad Robo. We already established that an Eved acts in place of his master. Hainu Shinish Al Arav Atzmo Ima Parah. That's only if the master himself was lent out with the animal. Then he can send his Eved as a proxy for the master. And in that case, it would be considered to be Sheila Bibalim. But in a case here where he Shoshoel et Abdo, Havalei Kushoel Shtei Parot, Davdo Kebemato Dami. That here where he says, send your Eved with it, or he does send his Eved with it, that's not called Sheila Bibalim, because over there the Eved has no independent standing as the Balim. He is simply property of the Balim. And so when he sends the Eved, he sends the Beimah, it's as if he's sending two animals. Not that the Eved's an animal, but in terms of property rights, he's sending two of his possessions to the individual. He's not putting the Eved in a position where it's Sheila Bibalim. And therefore, Tosafot extends what Rashi is saying to explain why this is not classified as Sheila Bibalim, because the Eved is only considered to be Balim when he steps into the shoes of the Balim and becomes what the Balim were supposed to do. But over here, where the Balim did not commit themselves, but simply sent their Eved to watch over the animal, that's not considered to be Sheila Bibalim. And Tosafot notes over here that once the animal leaves the property of the Mash'il, that he becomes Chayav. He says, the Chora Nira, the Mayrish Yatzta Miyad, the Simta, Oletzidei Rishut Rabim. It must be, if it's not a case where it's a captive property, and Rav says over there that you are Chayav as soon as it exits the property, it must have to go into an area that is considered to be not Rishut Rabim. Because if it goes straight into Rishut Rabim, there is no Kinyan Mishicha, there's no form of Kinyan in the Rishut Rabim. Tosafot clearly does not think like the Ran, that a Revut is the mechanism for generating the Kinyan over here. Tosafot says that he thinks that it's a Kinyan Mishicha, and the Kinyan Mishicha is being accomplished because the property or the type of property it's going into allows the Shoel to take possession of the animal. But that creates a problem if it exits directly into Rishut Rabim. Because in that situation, then, there is no form of Kinyan. There's no ability to have a Kinyan Mishicha in Rishut Rabim. So Tosfot, unlike the Ran, clearly is looking for a formal type of Kinyan to make the Shoel Chayav. And he says it's happening by the fact that it is going into this property where he has the ability to take possession of it. And that's sufficient. The Ran could argue on the Balei Tosfot and say even if it exits to Rishut Rabim, he'd still be Chayav, he's Chayav mitzad Arevut, and not mitzad Kinyan. Now Tosfot then backs away from this and says, V'od yesh domar, d'ochi mayra vil yatsat miyad Rishut Rabim. Here you could argue, even in a situation where it goes directly into Rishut Rabim, that in order to be chayav for onsin, it might be enough when it goes out into Rishut Rabim, even though it's not sufficient in terms of a transactional situation, going out into Rishut Rabim would not allow for a kinyan to take place. So Tosfot over here says that you can bifurcate the din of a shoel, which is that there are two pieces to the kinyan. One kinyan makes it that the transaction is locked in. There's another kinyan that makes you chayav in unsin. And what Tosfot is suggesting is that the threshold to make you chayav in unsin is lower than the threshold for making it in a transaction that now cannot be reversed. And he says, we're going to have examples of this coming up in the Gemara, where you can generate obligations even though you have yet to lock in the transaction. And so therefore, Tosafot suggests, he doesn't explain the exact mechanism for it, but he says that maybe Rishut Rabim can still generate a kinyan for the Shoel in order to be chayav for onsin. Again, the Ran formulates that, or gives it teeth by saying that it's a revut, that it's guarantor. But that's what basically Tosafot, in a, some sense, is saying something of a similar nature, which is you can become responsible for the animal, even though you don't have a formal kinyan that makes it that he can't back out of the transaction. And so therefore, you could actually become responsible before the actual transaction takes place. And that, again, would be similar to what the Ran was suggesting. The Ran just gives articulation to it, calling it arevut. So now, Amar Rav Huna, Ushuel kordom mi chavero, person who borrows an axe from his friend. Bakabo kano. If he uses it to chop wood, to split wood, then he acquires it. Lo bakabo, if he has yet to use it or utilize it, lo kano. He does not get a kinyan over it. Lamai. What is the kinyan that we're looking for over here? Ilay malon sim. If you're telling me it's to be responsible for anything that happens to the axe, maishna para demishat sheila. Why is it any different than the para that from the moment of borrowing you become responsible for the item? You don't need to do or work with the animal in order to become chayav. Simply borrowing it makes you responsible. So it's clear that Ravuna believes that a kinyan mishicha is not sufficient over here because he has the axe in hand. And yet still, kinyan mishicha is not sufficient. So the Gemara wants to know, what are you trying to create through this kinyan? If it is responsibility, responsibilities start much earlier. They start at the time either as a kinyan mishicha, or like we've been saying, whether the Balei Tosafot or the Iran, that there is some sort of acceptance of responsibility even without a kinyan mishicha. But that takes place even without using it. Now you're using it. What does that add that you didn't have before? Ela lechazara. That is for backing out of the transaction. Which is that the lender said you can borrow it. And so now the borrower wants to borrow it. At what point does he lock in the lending that the lender offered him? And that is once he uses it. Until he uses it, the lender can retract his offer for him to borrow it. And he can say, you know what, I changed my mind. Once he has utilized it, he can't back out of that transaction. So that's what it means. Bakabo lo matzi hader bay mashil. Once he's utilized it, then the lender can't back up out of it. Lo bakabo, if he has yet to use it, matzi mashil hader bay, then the lender can back out of the transaction. Upliga de Rabbi Yami. And this disagrees with the position of Rabbi Yami. The Amar Rabbi Yami, a mashil kardom shel ekdesh, person who lends out the acts of ekdesh, ma'al lefi tovat ana shibo. He is ma'al based on the goodwill that he generates from it. And his friend can utilize it without any problem. So here you have an individual who takes an axe from Hekdesh, and then in order to be chayav, you have to actually either take it out of the possession of Hekdesh, or you have to utilize it. So now he, instead of utilizing it, decides to gift it or lend it to his friend in order to utilize. Now when you lend something to someone, you are generating goodwill. You are doing something that has value. People would pay for that goodwill, or people would pay you in order to facilitate the ability to borrow such an item, or have you lend such an item. So you have now taken monetary benefit from Hekdesh when you lend it to your friend, because you're generating goodwill between you and this individual by utilizing the acts of Hekdesh. That is called mi'ilah. Mi'ilah is misappropriation of Hekdesh. And that's what you did over here. You misappropriated Hekdesh because you're using it for your personal benefit rather than the benefit of Hekdesh. Then, the person who is the recipient of the gift doesn't have to worry about it, and you can use it without any qualms. Because we have a principle that once you violate mi'ilah, the item is yotzeh l'chulin. Once you've misappropriated Hekdesh, it has profaned the item, and the item is no longer belongs to Hekdesh. So now that you got benefit from it, and you utilized it, you've changed it now from being Hekdesh to Chulin. And therefore the recipient of your gift can use it, lechatchila, without any problems. Now from Rashi it seems that the individual pays for the Tovat Hana'ah, even though the item might remain as Hekdesh. That's what Rashi says, that even though the new person knows that it belongs to Hekdesh, nevertheless he's not obligated not to use it, because the Tovat Hana'ah, or the benefit of that axe, already went to Chulin, even though the item itself might still remain as Hekdesh. The Ritva disagrees and says that when we start going to Chulin here, we mean it's completely going to Chulin, and that the Tovat Hana'ah, even though that's not the full value of the axe, nevertheless, that is all that he got benefit for, and all we can be mechayevim for it, it takes the axe from being an item of Hekdesh to being an item of Chulin. So Rashi seems to indicate that it's the Hana'ah that he's paying for, and therefore the Hana'ah is no longer subject to the rules of Hekdesh, even though the item remains Hekdesh. The Ritva says no, that even the item itself no longer remains Hekdesh. And Tosfot himself vacillates between these two positions of Rashi and the Ritva, as to what exactly happened over here, although he does lean in the end towards Rashi's position that in the case here, it's only the Tova Tana'a that he has to pay for. The item remains Hekdesh, but it's freed from that problem of Mi'ilah with regards to getting benefit from it because he already paid for that through the Tova Tana'a. Whereas if he gifted the item to him totally and gave him full possession of it, then he'd be chayav to pay for the entirety of the item, and the entirety of the item would then go out to chulin. Ve'ilo kana'o amai ma'al. If the recipient doesn't have a kinyan on it, why is there mi'ilah? Va'amai chaveiro mutad avakeo bo l'chatchila. And why is his friend allowed to utilize it? Nehadre, let him return it. Ve'lo likne, he won't have to take possession of it. Ve'lo limo, and there won't be any mi'ilah. Meaning that if you think like Rav Huna, that the only time that it locks in the lending is when you've utilized it, then over here, when you simply lend the axe to the other individual and he has yet to use it, why are you chayav for mi'ilah? You did not generate the goodwill that is irreversible or which is not retractable because you can take it back. The lending is not of a permanent nature. That means that when the person who received it or borrowed it uses it, that's what generates the mi'ilah. That's what causes the problem. So why wait until he does that? Simply have him return it to the original lender. There'll be no mi'ilah now, and we can return it to Hekdesh. Why are we saying it's mutar l'chatchila? Rabbi Ami's position must be that lending it in of itself generates a kinyan. And that kinyan is what causes the mi'ilah, causes the misappropriation of Hekdesh. And since that's the case, the recipient has no issue anymore with using it because it's already yatsa lichulin. And so he clearly disagrees with Rav Huna's position. Upliga de Rabbi Elazar. And this also argues on Rabbi Elazar, meaning that Rav Huna also disagrees with this position of Rabbi Elazar. Tam Rabbi Elazar, kederach shetiknu mishicha belukuchot, kach tiknu mishicha bishomrim. Just like there is a kinyan mishicha for purchasers, so too there is a kinyan mishicha for shomrim, meaning that the shomrim also have a right to utilize the kinyan mishicha in order to generate the locking of the transaction. And so that, just like the chazal put into place a kinyan mishicha by purchasers and say that money is not a sufficient mechanism for creating a kinyan, you need to have a kinyan mishicha in order for the transaction to be locked, so too, a kinyan mishicha by shomrim works. So again, that would be against Rav Huna's position. Rav Huna clearly sees that mishicha is not enough. He wants you to be bokeya. He wants you to use it in order to be locked. Mishicha isn't sufficient. For Rabbi Elazar, mishicha is sufficient for you to lock in the transaction. Now, the Baal HaTosafot also clarify that and say, the kach tiknu mishicha b'shomrim, lo litchayev onsim kamar. You will not be responsible for onsim at that point. And he says that the mishicha here is simply a means to lock the transaction and make sure that the lender doesn't back out of the transaction. So the Baal HaTosafot suggests kinyan mishicha locks the transaction, but does not obligate you in the onsin at all. But you could argue, and you can see that in the Gra, that the Rambam says that when you talk about a kinyan mishicha by shomrim, the kinyan mishicha by shomrim works not only to lock the transaction, but also to put the individual into a position where it becomes chayav be onsin. So he does not separate, the Rambam doesn't separate between the two issues. It says the kinyan mishicha suffices for both of these to make you chayav. The Baal HaTosafot suggests that it's only with regards to the irreversibility of the transaction that the kinyan mishicha is effective, but with regards to chiyuv onsin, you have to do something like our Mishnah where he formally accepts that responsibility, not the kinyan mishicha that makes him chayav in onsin. Because the Gemara took it for granted before that, from the moment of borrowing, you become chayav in onsin. Because that Gemara is took for granted when it asked in Rav Huna before. So Tosafot says that this din is limited to a shuel and a socher, by which there's no right to reverse the transaction. Whereas by a shum achinam and shum asachar, the kinyan mishicha would not be relevant because the reversal of the transaction is really has to do with the depositor, and the shum achinam and shum asachar don't have any rights here to demand or lock in terms of making a kinyan mishicha. And the Ritva extends the Balei Tosafot and says it even applies to a Shomer Sachar because he's getting wages. And therefore he's depending on those wages, and the Kinyan will have a locking effect of obligating the depositor to pay him those wages. And so it actually turns out that you have three opinions here with regards to Meshicha. It's clear that Rabbi Elazar thinks that Meshicha is part of the Takanat Chachamim of Meshicha, like by Mecher. And therefore Meshicha here is only effective midrabanan, based on the Rishonim as to whether that makes it it's locked in or also is Mechayev you in the Onsin. Rabbi Ami believes that Meshicha works even midoraita, and therefore it generates a chiyuv mi'ilah simply by giving of the item over to the other party. And Rav Huna clearly believes that Meshicha has no impact whatsoever, not midrabanan and not midoraita. All right, so Tanya Nami Ochi, we have a braita that supports this position, Rabbi Elazar. Kashem shetiknu Meshicha b'lekuchot, kach tiknu Meshicha b'shomrim. So here you have a braita that says exactly what Rabbi Elazar says, which is that there is a kinyan Meshicha by Shomrim. Ukashem shekarka niknet bekesef shtaru chazaka, kach schirut niknet bekesef shtaru chazaka. And just like land can be acquired, we know this from the Mishnah in Kiddushin, through one of these three mechanisms, kesef, money, purchasing it with cash, shtar, some sort of document that documents the legal transfer of the title, or b'chazaka, you take some sort of action on the property, now gadar paratz, that gives you the rights to the property and makes it an irreversible transaction. So too by schirut, and the Gemara asks, schirut mayavidite. What do you need a kinyan for in terms of schirut? Why isn't a kinyan meshicha sufficient? Why do you need kesef shtar u'chazaka? Why can't a kinyan meshicha work when you're renting something from another party? So Rashi views the question here as why can you use kesef to generate a kinyan by schirut, which are mitaltalim? Schirut is subject to the same dinim as mecher, and by mecher, kesef doesn't work, only a kinyan meshicha. So why should kesef work over here? The Ramban and others disagree and say that the whole takanav meshicha, that kinyan kesef in the Torah doesn't work by mecher, is because of a problem that is unique to mecher. That's not a problem that exists by schirut, and there is no takana there. And therefore kesef would be a good vehicle for acquisition, and the question comes from shtar. Because shtar is not a mechanism by which you can acquire metaltolin. So what exactly are they speaking about here when we're talking about schirut? So Gemara says, Amar Chista, schirut karka. We're not talking about simply any type of rental, we're talking about a rental of land. And the rental of land works or functions like a kinyan on land. If you're purchasing land, these are the mechanisms for kinyan. Those same mechanisms are applicable by schirut, by you rent the land. Then, in order to lock in the transaction in terms of renting land, kesef and shtar and chazaka will be the vehicles to do so. All right, so now the Gemara moves on to a new topic. Amar Shmuel. Haiman de gozel chavitza de tamrei bichaveru. Someone who steals a block of dates from his friend. V'itpa chamishim tamrei. There are 50 dates in a block. It must have been a standard size, that when they press the dates together, they would keep them and cut them in blocks of 50. So now he has 50. If he sells it in the wholesale market for 50 tamarim, agav hadodi mizdamen benun nachichado. If he sells them in the wholesale market in one shot, all 50 of them, you pay 49 for that. So you pay ones less than the number of tamarim. Chada chada mizdamen benun. If you sell them on a retail basis, one by one, then you pay 50 because you pay as pruta per tamar. So basically there's a volume discount. If you buy 50, you get them at 49. If you sell them one by one, it costs a pruta per tamar. So the difference being the wholesale and retail price. So the retailers are buying them off the wholesalers at 49 and then reselling them at 50. It's not a great margin, but that seems to be what was happening. Lehejot mishaleim chamishim nachichado. If you stole from someone who was a layperson, then you have to pay them back 49. Lehekdesh, on the other hand, if you steal from Hekdesh, meaning that this block of Tmarim belonged to Hekdesh, and then you pay chamishim vechumshayu. You pay 50 plus a fifth on top of that, because when you are Moel in Hekdesh, in order to make reparations to Hekdesh, you have to pay back one and a fifth. So mashe'en kein bimazik, that's not true by damage, delo mishaleim chumsha. that you don't pay the extra fifth. The Amar, because we have a drush on the pasuk, ish ki yochal kodesh, when a person eats or consumes kodesh, prat lemazik, that the mi'ilah and paying the extra fifth are only when you get benefit from that item in a manner that gives you hana'ah. But if you simply destroy hekdesh, then you don't have to pay the fifth. Tosva points out that you don't even have to pay the principal amount, because we learned in Baba Kama the din of re'eyu v'lo hekdesh, that the dinim of the shomrim and the dinim of nizakim don't have application by hekdesh. And therefore, not only would you not be chayav the fifth, you may not even be chayav the principal amount as well. So the Gemara wants to now understand, why is there a difference between the layperson that you stole from and hekdesh that you stole from or misappropriated the item? Because one, we're saying that you pay 49 to, the hedjot, the layperson would pay 49 to, and hekdesh you pay 50 to. So that's what matkifla rabibi barabai, the hedjot, amay mishalem chamishim nachichado. Why to the layperson do you pay 50 minus 1, 49? Namele, why can't the owner of the block of dates say to him, ana chada chada hava mizvanilehu? I would have sold them one at a time, and I would have made 50 from it. So you really caused me a loss of 50 and not a loss of 49. Amar Rav Huna, brother of Yeshua, shamin beitza'a boto sedeh etznan. He's quoting the Mishnah in Baba Kama and Perka Kones, where we learn how to assess damage that is caused by an animal. Over there, Rashi explains in that when you go to assess the value of the damage that's done, you look at it vis-a-vis a beitza'a. You look at it based on the quantity of land that is considered to be a beitza'a, which is defined by either the seeding or the production of a square area of land that will result in a sa'a. So if that's the case, then we are what we call makil on the mazik. When someone takes something or damages something, in that case, we are makil to assess the value of the damage in a manner that is the kula. And so too over here, we're not being medactic to say that the value of the damage that he caused is really the 50 and not the 49. And so the way that Rashi explains it over here, as well as in Baba Kama, is that the Gemara later on also says that you always do a relationship of 1 to 60. So Rashi claims that there are really actually two different types of assessments over here. You first assess a Beit Sa'ah in the context of 60 Sa'ah. So we look at a field of 60 Sa'ah. How much is a Beit Sa'ah worth in that large field? So that's the first value. And then the second value that you assign is within a Beit Sa'ah. If he ate an arugah or a small amount within the Beit Sa'ah, then we assess how much that is in the context of a Beit Sa'ah. Because if you were to look at an arugah, a little patch, in a total of 60 Sa'ah, it would be so irrelevant that it would have no value whatsoever. So we do this two-staged evaluation according to Rashi. We first figure out how much a Beit Sa'ah is worth based on its context, its relationship to 60 Sa'ah. And then we look at the area that was eaten in the context of a Beit Sa'ah. How much was this Beit Sa'ah worth before the patch was eaten? And how much is it worth after the patch is eaten? And that's the amount that the mazik has to pay. Again, it's clearly, ein medak takim liyot shamin ba'achila levada. We don't just look at the exact eating and the value of what he ate. Masha shava ha'arugah o shenechelet. We don't look at what the patch that he ate was worth. Elama nechsar beit sa'ah midamel. But rather, what the beit sa'ah lost from its value. Im haya balim kora karka im zriyata. Look at how much this Beit Sa'ah would sell for, leaving out this little piece or this little patch that was eaten. So obviously in the context of the larger Beit Sa'ah, it takes on less of a significance the amount that he ate. And that's a kula to the mazik. And the same thing over here. When it comes to the reparations being made, we're going to go to kula and assume that the individual is only entitled to 49 zuz and not to the 50 zuz. Tosafot over here, as well as Tosafot in Baba Kama, argues on Rashi's explanation because he says we never find the Gemara or the Mishnah giving a source for the fact that there's this dual valuation. Rashi says that the valuation is done in two stages. Again, figuring out what the value of a Beit Sa'ah is in the context of 60 Sa'ah. And then, once you know what the Beit Sa'ah is, then you try to assess the value of the arugah that was eaten in the context of that Beit Sa'ah, which makes it a two-leveled valuation. The Baal Tosafot said we find no source for that. In addition, he also says that the language is problematic. And the fact that it uses lashon nikeva, the fact that it uses haya and not hayta, shows you that it's referencing the sadeh and not the beitza'a. Menir lari, the shamin beitza'a, einu beitza'a ne'achal. That when we talk about, that we assess the value of the damage that was done, we look at shamin beitza'a, einu beitza'a ne'achal. We're looking at a beitza'a that was eaten. It's talking about the amount of produce. We're not talking about the amount of land that is planted that the animal ate, a beit za'ah. Rather, we're looking at a beit za'ah is meaning that what did he eat in terms of the produce that was there. And therefore, all the Mishnah says is that the animal consumed a beit za'ah. The Gemara then wants to know, what does that mean, or how do I deal with a beit za'ah? Now that the beit za'ah is a measure of comparison or relationship, but that is the amount of damage that was done. And then given that damage, how do we assess it? Since the Mishnah itself doesn't address that issue. It just says, Shamin Beitza'ah, Tosadeh, but doesn't give you what the value relationship is. Because the Mishnah never describes to you what the size of the field is that you're comparing it to. And to that, we have the Amoraim, on Daf Nun Chet Amud Bet, in Baba Kama, that describe what they think that relationship is. And therefore, it's a Machloket Amoraim as to whether you assess it always based on a Beitza'ah in the context of 60 Sa'ah. And then you relate that to the actual damage that was done? Or is it always a 60-to-1 relationship? No matter what the size of the damage, you always relate it to 60 times that amount to assess the amount of damage that is done. Now, like Rashi suggests that the Mishnah has one mechanism of valuation, which is keneged beit za'ah, and then the Daf Nun Chet has a second mechanism of valuation. How do you assess the beit za'ah in the first place? And that's the meaning of shamin beit za'ah boto sadeh tnan, which is that you assign it or you assess it based on a sa'ah worth of tvuah. Mar says, the memra, the sabar Shmuel dinejot lav kedin gevo adami. From this you would assume that Shmuel's position is that lay people and Hekdesh do not have the same din. Because according to Shmuel, a lay person would only get 49, but Hekdesh would get 50. Vatz nan. Don't we see that Shmuel equates position of a lay person to that of Hekdesh? Nataleben ukura mekdesh, a person who takes a stone or a beam from Ekdesh, the Gemara qualifies this that this is talking about the gizbar, the treasurer himself. So the mere taking of the item is not mi'ilah, because he has permission to take it or to work with these items because he is the treasurer of Ekdesh. So the fact that he took it home doesn't mean anything. Lo ma'al. Natanal the chaveiro, if he then gifts it or gives it to his friend, Hu ma'al v'chaveiro lo ma'al. He is subject to mi'ilah because he's now changing the possession of the item, and therefore he's responsible for the fact that he took it out of possession of Ekdesh and gave it to his friend. His friend obviously is not ma'al, because once you're ma'al, it goes out to chulin. Bana betoch beito. If he builds it into his house, lo ma'al, then there's no mi'ilah. The Gizbar himself, if he builds it into his house, there's no mi'ilah. The Gemara there explains again that that is a case where he built it in without changing the dynamic of the item itself. So simply he went onto his roof and there was a hole in the roof. Or he found a sunlight in the roof and he plugs the hole with this item. So he hasn't changed the object itself. And so therefore there's no kinyan over here. There's no mi'ilah. Ad shiyador tachta b'shave pruta. Then until he lives under it, the value of a shave pruta. So then you see that the mi'ilah only happens once he has benefited from the item. The benefit comes not from plugging the hole, but living under it once the hole is plugged. V'yoti Rabbi Yabohu kameh de Rabbi Yochanan, v'yoti v'kamar mishmeh de Shmuel. And then Rabbi Yabohu is sitting before Rabbi Yochanan and saying over the name of Shmuel, Zot Omeret. This means, Hadar b'chatzer chaveiro shelo midato. Someone who lives in his friend's property without his knowledge, Tzarech la'alot lo schar. He has to pay for that benefit. Basically, zenene v'ze lo chaser. That's the question of the Gemara in Baba Kama. So from this, he wants to conclude that you would have to pay for it. Because you see by mi'ilah that this is deemed to be a benefit, a monetary benefit, for which you are chayam mi'ilah. Well, if there's a monetary benefit, then you need to make monetary compensation for the benefit that you are receiving. And that means that if you are in the other person's property and live there, there is value that you are garnering monetary value that you should have to compensate the owner for. But what you see from this is that Shmuel is willing to extend a position that is true by Hekdesh over to a Hedyot, to a layperson. But now, in our case, he doesn't do that. Mar says, Hadar be Shmuel mihahi. Shmuel retracted that position. Now, the position that he's retracting is the second one that we brought, the idea that you can extend from Hekdesh. Mimai demai Hadar be. How do you know that that's what he reversed? Dilma maha Hadar. Maybe he reversed the other position. Maybe he reversed the position with regards to the 50 and the 49. Mar says, lo, it's clear that he reversed the position with regards to Hekdesh. Kidurova, because we have a memra from Rava that indicates, Damarova, Hekdesh, Shalomidat, Kejot, Midat, Dami. Because we have a principle by Hekdesh, that Hekdesh, Shalomidat, has the same din as Hejot, Midat. Hekdesh without knowledge is the same thing as a layperson with knowledge. Now that comes for two reasons, as Rashi explains over here. The simplest of which is the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu always knows. And the Hekdesh belongs, in a sense, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, when you live or utilize or benefit from Hekdesh, then Hashem knows. And even though it's Shalomidat, meaning without permission of the Gizbar, without the permission of Hekdesh, that's irrelevant because God knows about it. The second thing is that by Baalim, Midat and Shalomidat, is the opportunity for the owner to object. And so, midat ha-baalim means that the owners are not objecting to what you are doing. Versus shalom midat, where the owners can't object because they don't know about it. By Hekdesh, there's nobody to object. Meaning that there's no formal owner of Hekdesh that can come along and reject your ability to use this, utilize this. Because in essence, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the one who owns it. And he's not going to make an objection to what you do, aside from what the Torah tells you is objectionable. But it doesn't mean that he's going to give you or tell you not to be there. And so therefore, for those two reasons, Hekdesh Shalomidat, Hekdesh without knowledge, you know, without permission of Hekdesh, is the equivalent of having dat, as if there was knowledge there. Because in the case of a joke with knowledge, that would determine or distinguish between the owner's ability to reject what you're doing, versus if he doesn't know about it, he can't reject it. By Hekdesh, it's irrelevant, because there's going to be no rejection whether it's known or not known. The second thing is that it's always Midat Baalim, because the Baalim are HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore Hekdesh is considered to be Midat. If that's the case, then you can't draw a conclusion about a Hedyot, a layperson, from something that came from Hekdesh, in the case of Me'ilah, where here he lives under the roof. He's getting benefit from the fact that he's living under the roof. That's a din of Me'ilah, because that's if he's doing that with the knowledge of Hekdesh. On the other hand, where it's a layperson and there is no dat, then you can't equate the cases. You can't say that he's doing midat and he's garnering benefit midat the baalim. The baalim don't even know about it. Since they don't know about it, you can't make a claim for monetary compensation in that case. And shalom midat doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't know about it, it's just simply that he didn't ask permission to do it. So he might be aware of the fact that the individual is there, but he never asked permission. Obviously, that doesn't happen by Hekdesh, because there's no one to ask permission of, and so therefore it's always, quote-unquote, Midat. And therefore that comparison between Hejod and Hekdesh was not correct, and that's why Shmuel backed away from it, and his statement here with regards to the Tamarim is a better position, which is that there are differences between Hekdesh and Hedyot. And even though we're discussing here the position of Shmuel, the Gemara views Rava's position as being so fundamental to the understanding of the difference between Hedyot and Hekdesh, that of course Shmuel would also subscribe to that distinction, and that's why we would believe that Shmuel would back away from the assumption that he made. Again, even though it's not always true, Rava's distinction of Dat and Shalomidat, nevertheless it's sufficiently relevant by that difference between Hekdesh and Hedyot, that we would not make assumptions of extending some din that's applicable by Hekdesh to that of a Hedyot, to that of a layperson. So Amar Rava, Haini Shokolai de Tavru Chavita de Chamra lechanva. These transporters, schleppers, they were carrying a barrel of wine for this storekeeper, for this individual who was a retailer of wine. If they break the barrel how do we compensate the retailer for the fact that they broke the wine? Because the barrel of wine is worth different amounts on different days. B'yom ha'shuka mizdav no behei. On the day of the shuk, he can sell that wine for 5. B'shar yomei, if it's not the day of the shuk, mizdav no barba. It only sells for 4, because then the individual has to keep it until the next shuk, and then sell it in the shuk. So you get less value for the barrel of wine if you sell it on a non-shuk day. So here they broke his barrel. When they're coming to compensate him, what is the damage they do? Do we look at the damage as being the 5, which he could monetize it for on the day of the shuk? Or do we look at it as the 4, which he would get at any other time? So if they give him back the barrel on the day of the shuk, then they can just give him back the barrel of wine. So Rashi says here, call them Shiagir Yom HaShuk. If they return it before the day of the Shuk, Shiacholim Ochrabi Yom HaShuk, since he would be able to sell it on the day of Shuk, Shiagir Rishon, the first Shuk that would come, since they've already given him the barrel back, Madulei Chavita Dechamra, then they have to pay him back of wine, because he will still be able to realize the 5 at the Shuk. On the other hand, Bishar Yomei, if on the other days they return it to him, Madulei Hey, they return him 5. The way the Gemara reads, or the Girsa that we have in the Gemara is, if they return him the barrel of wine prior to the shuk, they can simply just give him a barrel of wine. Because then they've replaced the item that he lost, and he can still monetize it for the 5. The other hand, if they give it to him after the shuk, after that day of the shuk, then they can no longer return him a barrel of wine, because he can't realize with that barrel of wine 5 anymore, until the next shuk, and then he'll have to hold on to it, but basically they're giving him back 4 at that point. So instead, the way Argumar reads, they have to give him 5. They have to actually pay him the 5 zuz that the barrel was worth. It's only true if he didn't have wine to sell. If he did have wine to sell, then he should have sold it. And since he didn't sell it, they don't have to give him full compensation, but rather they can deduct from that his efforts and Dmei Bar Zanaita, which we'll see in Rashi brings 2 or 3 explanations as to what Dmei Bar Zanaita is. So according to the Girsa that we have, and the way that Rashi explains it, is that if they get him back the barrel of wine prior to the day of the Shuk, then they can simply return him the barrel of wine, and he's no worse off than he was before, because he can just sell it at that Shuk. Now Tosfot qualifies that and says, Perish kodem shavar yom ha-shuk ha-rishon. That's only the first shuk. They can't say, oh, we're giving it to you before the next shuk, because then he didn't have the money in hand, and then he has to wait around for it. What he wants is that day of the shuk, the first one that's coming, if they get it back to him before that day of the shuk, then they haven't caused him any loss, because he can continue to do what he was planning on doing, which is monetize it at the shuk. But if you're already past the day of the shuk, they can't give him a barrel of wine, but they have to give him money because he could have monetized at the Yom HaShuk. And now that they're giving him the value, it's not going to be the wine anymore, because the wine doesn't have that value now. And they have to actually pay him the 5 zuz that the wine was worth that he could have monetized at the Shuk. Because he doesn't have to wait until the next day of Shuk to monetize it. They got to give him cash right now. And that's why Rashi and the Balei Tosfot learn. Now, if he had wine in hand on the day of the Shuk, and he didn't bother to go to the shuk and sell it, so he had alternative wine to sell. He says, I was going to sell this barrel. You guys broke it, so I have nothing to sell now. Meantime, he does. He has a ton of other wine to sell, and he didn't bother to go sell it at the shuk. In that case, the Gemara says, well, he was lazy. He should have sold the wine at the shuk. The fact that he didn't sell him the wine at the shuk is a benefit to him, because now these individuals are coming to pay him back or going to give him 5 zuz as if he sold it in the shuk. But he did no work for that. And on top of that, he would have to have paid someone either to advertise. That's what Rashi says. Debei Bar Zanaita means somebody go around and be machriz to advertise for him that he's selling wine. Or Yitziat Hayayin HaNimkar BeBarza BePrutot. Or the cost of selling the wine in smaller quantities. Or Rashi says, which seems to be the explanation in other places in Shas, Dmei Bar Zanaita is the tapping of the barrel. Tapping of the barrel required a skilled person to do that. And since now he's getting his money back without having him to pay someone to tap the barrel, he's saving money. And so what the Gemara says is that the 5 shekel, 5 zuz that you pay back, We will deduct from that, number one, the savings of not having to have to advertise, or the savings of not having to deal with these small quantities, or the savings of not having to tap a barrel, that they will deduct from the 5 shekel. In addition to that, they will also deduct the value of him taking a vacation day instead of working in the shuk. Had he had to sell it in the shuk, he would have had to have been there all day working. Instead, he got a day off, and he's getting paid the same amount. How much would a person accept to stay home instead of go to the shuk and get the same compensation? So obviously, he would be willing to take less compensation in order to get the vacation day. That less compensation, they also deduct from the 5. So they're going to pay him 5 minus what cost he would have incurred to sell it, and minus the efforts or the exertion he would have had to make to sell it. And that's what they pay him, according to Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot. So depending when you pay it back, you either give him wine because he can realize the same amount. If he can't realize the same amount, you've got to pay him cash. But if he had wine that he could have sold at the Yom HaShuk, and instead he just says, I want your money, the 5 that I would have gotten from this barrel, then yes, we give him the 5 minus the expenses and the vacation day that he got, because he doesn't deserve the full 5. He deserves 5 minus whatever expenses he saved, as well as the vacation day that he got. So if you look in the Groh over here in Ot, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, over here brings the other Rishonim, who clearly disagree or view this sugya differently. The first thing is, Bet says that where we say hey, that you have to pay 5, the Rambam, on the other hand, and the Rif, say that it's Dalet. When you didn't give him a barrel of wine back, you only give him 4 zuz. And he explains, Mefareish Rambam, Dibichavit, Leolam Yachol Shalem. You're always entitled to pay a barrel of wine. Ela Dima'ot Mishalem Kemosh Shaveh B'Shat Tashlumim. But on the other hand, if you pay back monetary compensation, then you pay the value of the barrel at that time. For Rashi, who the hefech? Rashi says just the opposite, which is, Rashi believes you only have a right to give the barrel of wine when you could still monetize it for 5. If you can't, then you need to give 5 in cash. That's Rashi's view. The Rambam's view is you can always give him a barrel of wine because now you've replaced whatever he lost. And that's irrespective of the fact that he has to wait for the next shuk. And if you want to give him cash compensation, if it's before the shuk, you pay him 5. If it's after the shuk, you only pay him 4, the exact opposite of Rashi, because that's what a barrel of wine is worth today. So if you give him 4, he can go into the market and buy a barrel of wine to replace the one that was lost. So you give him 4. Before the shuk, he can't replace it. At 4, he has to replace it at 5, so you have to give him 5 in cash. That is the view of the Rambam. So that's the first distinction that we have in the Rishonim, is what is the mechanism for payment? Rashi says it's a barrel of wine or 5. Meaning that basically it's 5 and 5. Either you give him a barrel of wine that's worth 5, or you pay him 5 in cash. The Rambam is really the other way around. Either you give him a barrel of wine, no matter when it is, and whatever the value of the barrel of wine is at that time, that's the cash that you would pay him. 5 or 4, depending on when you gave him the barrel back. Now, in addition to that, we have an additional distinction of Rashi, which is Lo Amran. Rashi says, we only say that's true when there is no other wine to sell. If he has other wine to sell, then we don't say that. The way I would have read the Gemara is not what Rashi doesn't seem to be the simplest way to read the Gemara, which is, well, he had other wine and he stayed home. What I would say is that he had other wine to sell at the Shuk, and he did sell that wine in the Shuk. So he was able to monetize the wine at 5 because he had an alternate wine to sell. Since he had alternate wine to sell, he sold it and he still has wine left over. So that means that even if he had this other barrel of wine, he would not have benefited from that because he didn't sell out. Since he didn't sell out, he now shouldn't be entitled to more money. And that's what the Ragra brings here in the Ot Gimel. Here Benaya, Varambam Varosh Mifashim, the Kaya Yom HaShuk. It's talking about the Shuk. The I Itle Lizvune Shave the Shar Yome. That if he has wine to sell, then it's no different than any other day. Because he got the benefit of the Shuk, because he had wine to sell the Shuk. So that wasn't the problem. So now when you give him back the barrel of wine, what is he entitled to? So the Rosh, like Rashi, says he's entitled to 5, like on any other day. The Rambam will believe, like he did, that on any other day, he'd only be entitled to 4. Because the Yom HaShuk becomes irrelevant now, because he had an alternative quantity to sell on the Yom HaShuk. And since now there's no value that's created from having this wine before the Shuk or after the Shuk, because he has alternatives, then the only value you look at is what's the value on the non-Yom HaShuk day. So for Rashi and the Rosh, that's 5, and for the Rambam, that's 4. And that's what you would pay on those days. The last thing is, what the Balei HaTosafot say is, Perish Kodem Shavar Yom HaShuk HaRishon. And there you see in Dalit in the Gra, he says, Nir Bein, I barosh mifaresh, b'yom ashuk mamash. B'chol yom ashuk, v'lab dafka rishon. That it means, first of all, not before the yom ashuk. The Rosh says literally on the day of the shuk. If you give it back to him on the day of the shuk, you can give him the chavit. If you give it before the day of the shuk, then it's equivalent of any other day because you're giving him a time that's not the shuk. Number two is it doesn't matter whether it was the first shuk or another shuk. Obviously, it makes a difference because for the Balei Tosafot, since you can give it to him before then it only matters for the first Yom HaShuk. It's going to be a later Yom HaShuk you can give beforehand, then you're never going to have a day that's not Yom HaShuk because there will always be an upcoming Yom HaShuk. So for the Balei Tosafot and Rashi, then before Yom HaShuk means literally before that first Shuk that comes about. Afterwards, it becomes like Shar Yomei. For the Rosh, who thinks that Yom HaShuk means literally the day of the Shuk, that means that when you return it on any day that is the shuk, he can monetize it for 5, and you're not making him keep it around. So he's no worse off than he was before. If you return the barrel on the day of the shuk, he has what to sell on the day of the shuk, and he can monetize it for 5. Shariome, if you give him a barrel of wine, he can only get 4 for it. Then you have to pay him 5, according to the Rosh. And as the Gra notes, that's the Rosh, the Shitato, who thinks that the damages are determined by the day that it got broken. It was broken on Yom HaShuk. Then he owes them the value of Yom HaShuk. If it was broken on an alternate day, then they only owe him the value of on the day that it was broken. So here you have a series of differences within the Rishonim. One difference is the value that you have to return. How do we assess the damages over here? According to Rashi, the Balei Tosafot, the Rosh, it is either a barrel of wine or 5. Those are your alternatives. According to the Rambam, it's always a barrel of wine. And if you don't give the barrel of wine, you give what the value of that barrel would be, which is 5 and 4. Not that you always pay him 5. The second difference that we saw was whether having wine in hand, what does that do to the situation? According to Rashi, it makes it that the individual didn't sell wine at the Yom HaShuk, even though he had wine. And that indicates that it wasn't so important to him. And therefore, he gets compensation that deducts the value of not having to go and sell in the Shuk. Whereas the Rambam and the Rosh view this as, if he had wine to sell at the Shuk, he didn't lose anything. Since he didn't lose anything, because he had this wine, then you don't have to pay him the full amount. You have to pay him what it would be on Shar Yomei. Now that has to, for the Rosh, that's 5. And for the Rambam, that's 4. The other difference we saw was that, when is it considered to be Yom HaShuk? The Balei Tosafot and Rashi, that means before the first Shuk. As for the Rosh, it means any Yom HaShuk that you come across, that's considered to be Yom HaShuk. Okay, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Tzadik Ted Amud Bet.